You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So earlier I spoke with Kate Schutz, who's the Pacific researcher for Amnesty International. And Kate has, she's recently spent a bit of time over in Manus Island, and she's just released a report yesterday which talks about the transfer of refugees from one containment facility to another.
Wow.
And sort of the nasty things that went on during that.
Mm.
And I started off by asking her if she could just help us understand a little bit better what Manus Island is and the history behind it and its relationship with refugees.
2013, the Australian government has sent just over 1,000 people to Manus Island. They've sent only men to Manus Island, and of course women and children were sent to Nauru at around the same time. So most of these men have been there now for 4.5 years. We've got around 800 people, most of them on Manus Island, but around 100 to 150 in Port Moresby now. We know that 600 of that 800 have been assessed as refugees under the process set up by the Australian government with the PNG authorities. So essentially what we've seen happen and change in the last couple of months is that Australia has closed the initial refugee centre that was purpose-built to hold refugees there, and they've moved into several centres closer to Lorengau town on Manus Island. This, of course, has placed enormous strain on the local community there and caused a lot of resentment to the locals who weren't consulted. They've also done a range of things in terms of winding back support and services to those refugees in the last few months. So reduced healthcare is now provided by the Australian government for after hours or emergency care. They're expected to go to the local hospital, which we visited there. Of course, Papua New Guinea has very poor healthcare generally. It's slightly better in places like Port Moresby, especially if you can afford private healthcare. But essentially, these men are given an allowance which isn't sufficient for them to live on. You know, they are, of course, supplemented with some food, but they have to now buy all their medications in town from that allowance, which is around $31 US a week, which I think is about $43 New Zealand last time I checked.
I was just going to hold you up there and say, you mentioned it's put an enormous strain on the local community. What's the relationship like between the refugees, asylum seekers, and that local community?
I think like any society, it's a little bit mixed. We met with some people who are quite supportive and sympathetic towards the refugees who'd been sent there and had closely interacted with them. But we also met with others who, for example, were quite concerned about relationships between local women and refugees. We met with others who were concerned about their land rights because this new facility obviously has sewage runoff going onto the neighbouring sites, and the people with houses right next to that facility were never consulted about this massive construction going on right next to them. You know, we've also seen play out in the last couple of weeks that the landowner and rival contractors like the security company are fighting each other out because they're seeing the money coming in from the Australian government and they all want a piece of it. So they're fighting with each other, leaving the refugees caught in the middle of this conflict and this awful situation on the island.
The contractors seem to have a large part to play in this. I was reading in the report, in your report, that in 2016 the PNG government ruled that this sort of practice was unlawful, but it took another 18 months for the Australian government to act on it. But that coincided when the contractor's contract was running out. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So we haven't had any explanation from the government in terms of why it took them so long to change this and why, if they were complying with the court decision, there's been no real change to the situation or the freedom or the safety that refugees now have in these new sites. They're moved from one site to another where there's similar problems with unsanitary conditions, overcrowding, lack of freedom, lack of safety. So it's more of the same, essentially. And I think it's important that we call out the Australian government and this smoke and mirrors approach to what's happening on Manus Island.
You mentioned the gradual wind back in resources, such as electricity and water and medical supplies to the camps. How did the actual transfer work? Was this just sort of like attrition, sort of we waited out until they cannot bear it any longer, or were they forcefully removed?
I think the Australian government expected it would happen by natural attrition if they removed some of those services. But, you know, these refugees have been there for 4.5 years, nearly 5 years now for some of them. You know, that was for them an opportunity to highlight their situation to the world outside, and they did that by peacefully protesting and staying within that centre to highlight their concerns. The Australian government never responded to a lot of the issues that they were raising through those protests, like their safety and security, you know, the threats they were receiving from the local community at the time, don't move out of here, if you do, we will kill you. That was the kind of response that they were getting. So instead of peacefully transferring these people and engaging with them to get them to move, it resulted in this standoff, essentially, for 3 weeks, where the refugees refused to move, the PNG authorities didn't know what to do. The Australian authorities were still on the island, but playing a much more behind-the-scenes role. And on the 23rd and 24th of November, the police and the immigration officials went in, and they yelled at refugees, they threatened them, they were armed with sticks and knives, some of them. In one video that we were sent by refugees, you can see a uniformed man beating a refugee on the ground with a what looks like a metal stick. You know, so there was a lot that happened. I mean, obviously there weren't more serious injuries as could have happened in that situation, but there were minor injuries. It could have been managed a lot better, a lot more peacefully and a lot more securely. But everything around this system that Australia has set up is designed to inflict cruelty. It's designed to add to the pressure on refugees to coerce them to return home. And this transition between different centres was no different to the rest of the plan.
There seems to be an understanding between the PNG and Australian governments that there is cooperation in the sense that the dirty work of going in there with the sticks and the knives is taken care of by the PNG authorities, and it leaves the Australian government sort of a bit safer from the blame of that. But then if you're really to take a step back and ask why the situation is occurring in the first place, that blame would have to rest with the Australian government.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that ultimately Australia has sent these people far away as possible. They may remain responsible for their welfare, essentially. What we've seen change over the last few months is Australia's withdrawn to become more behind the scenes, but they're still very much asserting control. They still instruct all of the contractors and manage the contractual relationships with the service providers. They're less visibly present to the refugees, so it creates extra layers of bureaucracy. No one really knows who's in control except that Australia ultimately is. They're still bankrolling this situation on Manus Island. So I think the Australian government cannot claim that it does not have responsibility for these people when it's still heavily involved in everything that's happening there. But I would also say with that transition, the PNG authorities, how it was handled, they need to take some responsibility for that too, because it was PNG immigration and police, and they assured us that they weren't going to go in and use force when we were there in early November, and ultimately they did. I think, you know, that comes down to fundamental challenges in the PNG police force that they need to accept responsibility for, but the overriding system is still orchestrated and controlled by the Australian government.
So focusing in a bit more on the individuals that are caught in this sort of whirlwind, what are the long-term effects that we're starting to see on the refugees who have been there for, some of them, 4.5 years, isolated away from friends and family, without state, without community?
Yeah, so there have been some medical experts that UNHCR has sent in to both Manus and Nauru, and they've said that 88% of refugees and asylum seekers are now suffering from some kind of depressive or anxiety disorder, as well as other more serious mental health conditions. They're saying that's amongst the highest they've seen in a refugee population before, which is quite extraordinary. And I think a lot of this comes down to the prolonged uncertainty, the fact that there are no clear plans for their future. Yes, some people might win this lottery ticket of being settled in the US, but we know not everyone's going to go. We know that certain nationalities have been excluded from that process, so On the one hand, this deal is very bittersweet for those refugees who feel excluded for them from that process and feel like they have no hope now on Manus Island.
The role of humanitarian organisations such as Amnesty International, is it relatively free and easy over in Manus Island, or are there a few roadblocks towards people like yourself getting out there and helping and finding solutions?
I think one of the biggest challenges is that the Australian government deliberately places these people in remote, hard-to-reach places. So it's very expensive to get to Manus Island. It's one of the most northern provinces in Papua New Guinea, so again, remote within that situation. And I think once you get there, we experience being turned away from various sites where we're talking to refugees by the police, by immigration officials. So it's obvious that they're very cagey and don't want us to interact with refugees and asylum seekers, even if it's outside the centres. So that access issue makes it incredibly difficult to get clear information about what's happening. But people like Behrouz Bouchani, the Iranian journalist who's there, and others have been, fantastic advocates and promoting and getting their message across where they can. I would also say this, though, Manus Island, the internet coverage is dismally inadequate. So even transferring information and getting information out, like sending videos and photos when something happens, is challenging and difficult to do. So I think it's all part of this master plan by the Australian government to place them far from the reach of public eye and continue to dehumanise what's going on there.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.